their access of the House Committee on Healthcare. And I need to make a couple of announcements. We are, without hearing, going to move House Bill 3502 out of the Access to Committee and move it with the Speaker's permission, which we haven't gotten yet, to the Monday meeting of the full committee. We have an agreement between all sides on that bill, and it's an important bill, and it shouldn't have a fiscal with it, but we'll see. But we'll take that up on Monday, given that we get the Speaker's permission on it. And it will be scheduled for a work session. We have heard the bill. Okay, good. Anne's a rational person. We can work some out.
Oh, it's supposed to be 34.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3090. Can I ask Kristen Leonard to join us? Here she is.
Okay.
It's my understanding is we're working on some amendments, but they're not quite ready. Could you just put that on the record for me, and we'll move the bill. So.
Chair Greenlight, members of the committee, Kristen Leonard on behalf of SEIU, and I just wanted to say we're at this point in time not prepared to give you a lot of information about House Bill 3090 because we are still working on it. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I would like an amendment to move 3090 without recommendation. I mean a motion.
Mr. Chair.
To move 3090 without recommendation to the full committee.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3090 without recommendation to the full committee.
Any discussion on that? We will have a gut and stuff. I'd like it enough in advance so we can actually look at it. It's not the bill that's there. And we'll, I suppose we need to, oh yeah, it says it. It's a hearing. We'll please try to get the amendments as fast as we can and make sure it gets to all the committees so they've had a chance to think about it. We got a bunch of them showed up today. We'll try and avoid that happening. I'll close the public hearing on HB 30. We need to vote.
Well, you close the public hearing now. Open a work session.
Oh, okay.
And now I'll take your motion.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3090 to the full committee without recommendation.
Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye.
The 3090 moves to the full committee. We'll have a work session on it on Monday. Definitely bring your pajamas on Monday. I will close the work session on 3090, and I'd like to open a work session on HB 2015 and HB 3492. Somebody here representing what used to be the STAR, that used to be known, formerly known as the Board of Medical Examiners. Would you please join us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners, and with me is Susan Erickson, who is an investigative coordinator for the board, and I asked her to be here to help answer technical questions, if you have any.
Yeah, I have one technical question we can start with, and that's, you heard in front of us a lot of testimony on both these bills, and there's clear dissatisfaction. I've heard from my vice chair that some of the same issues were raised in the last session in Ways and Means without any improvement on the part of the board. So the question is, would you like us to pass a couple of draconian bills that will force the board to do something, or is there any chance that you might get the board together and seriously address the issue of how to provide information to the public when they ask?
Mr. Chair, I think we'd be happy to review the processes that the board uses now. They actually have made several changes in the post-Patel era. And if I may separate malpractice claims from complaints, because they really are two separate things. Malpractice complaints are now reported much more frequently to the board. And those are posted separately from complaints. And I don't think the board has any objection to House Bill 2015. They don't necessarily support it, but we don't object to it. But in terms of reviewing processes for what the board receives in terms of information and what it makes public, we would be happy to do that and report back to you.
I think we have consensus that when a person calls up the board now to ask about information about a physician, they are not getting information that's useful to them to help them understand what's going on. And it runs all the way from the problem of saying we can't tell you anything that sounds like there's no problem to not providing information that ought to be provided. And if you will commit to taking a serious shot at it and getting a report to the appropriate interim committee, it will help us a lot if you have information. And if not, then we'll prepare things out of the interim committees that probably do what the bar does. You want to review for us, Mr. Vice Chair, what the bar does when somebody calls and asks, is this weirdo Dennis Richardson an okay attorney?
Say, not him again. Mr. Chair, there was a complete review of how the process took place with the Bar Association a number of years ago, and there was concern by the citizens that they felt that there was this kind of an inside job, that if citizens made complaints or something like that, the lawyers would take care of each other, and that, you know, it would be kind of a protected inside situation. So they changed the way that they handle things, and for years now it's been that if you want to know if there's been complaints against an attorney, you can call and they will say, yes, there have been the following complaints, and here's how they were resolved. And then citizens can make a decision as to whether the complaint and the resolution was something that influences their decision as to whether they want to go to that lawyer or to some other lawyer. But it's transparent, and it's very open, and it's citizen-friendly. It's the Bar Association protecting the citizens, not protecting the attorneys against the citizens. And, of course, you have rights of appeal and those kinds of things. And I would certainly hope, and I know that on 3492, there's, I think, 26 legislators who signed the greenback saying they hope, too, that the board would be focused on how do we best serve the needs and interests of the citizens as we regulate the physicians and make sure that if there's a doubt that it's in favor of the citizens and not where it looks like it's a protected old boy system watching out for the positions and sandbagging the inquiries of the citizens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I hear you very clearly, and I have already discussed this with the director, and I know she's discussed it with the board, and I think they will take this very seriously.
It would be very helpful if you could arrange for the director to send a letter to all the members of the board talking about this commitment and copy us with it so we can distribute that to the committee. That would be a very helpful first
Mr. step. Chair, we will do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hannon.
A comment on this. It seemed like, if I'm recalling the public hearing correctly, part of the problem turns on the meaning of the word complaint. Mm-hmm. And a citizen calls up and asks, have there been any complaints against the doctor? And the citizen is told no. Well, in fact, there have been complaints against the doctor, as I understand the meaning of the word complaint, only they haven't resulted in a fine or some sort of process, that judgment against the doctor. And that I think, is an issue that has to be resolved. And I don't know which side of that to come down on, whether the citizen who asks, have there been complaints, should be told, yes, there have, even though they weren't found, the doctor wasn't found in violation of anything. I don't know how to resolve that. I know that there's a real problem when there have been complaints in the common meaning of the word, but you're told there haven't been.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad that was brought up, Representative Buchanan, because the discussion was, what is complaint? And so one of the the annotations that I'd made on page 2 of the bill, where it talks about the existence and status of all complaints, and the words were added in, all signed and authenticated complaints. It's not enough just to grouse. So you've got to be willing to put my name on it and say, this is why I think it's a problem, so that it can be taken seriously. That also allows the board to say, I've got a piece of paper, this is what they're saying, and now, Mr. Physician, Doctor, here's what is being alleged. What is your response? Because quite often, it's just, you know, I was supposed to get better in 3 weeks, and it took 9 weeks, and I missed a lot of work. You know, but on the other hand, you know, and those kinds of things, a person had the right to make their complaint, and then they get a response, and, you know, and they've been listened to. But I would certainly agree that it needs to be a signed and authenticated bona fide complaint, not just grousing.
Mr. Chair, we will convey these suggestions.
President Maurer?
Definitely.
At risk of being antagonistic to other groups out there and not the Board of Medical Examiners, I think that the bottom line or the purpose of this bill is about protecting patients and allowing them to make choices, consumer choices, which I clearly, from the number of people that sign on, is a good idea. And I would not want to think that physicians are the only people that receive complaints from patients, and that it may be wise that the state look at all of its boards in regards to patient and how they make a complaint, so that we have consistency across the board from nurses, because nurses, it's not just about nurses, you know, staff nurses or nurses in clinics. You have independent providers, like my wife is an independent provider, and it would be appropriate that the complaint system for my wife would be the same or very similar to what is expected or found for a physician, given that they both have direct contact with patients and both have impact on their well-being. So I would suggest that we may expand this because we're going to come back next time and fix maybe the physician's role, but there are other providers out there across the board that we're going to have to address the same issue.
You know, it might be possible in May, we're going pretty crazy with a bunch of Senate bills, but it might be useful to have an informational hearing where we ask some of the other professional boards to come in and talk to us about how they handle it. That might be good background. Sandy, let's see if we can figure out a way. Probably, the truth is it'll probably be earlier in May. We'll be less swamped in labor money, and that might be.
Sorry.
It's possible the Senate won't send any more bills.
Oh,
right,
yeah.
No,
good. Yeah.
But I don't think we should bank on that. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing. I'm sorry, the work session on 2015 and 3492. And open a work session on House Bill 3097, where we have a full-blown gut and stuff amendment that everybody loved. And if you'll just brief us a little bit more, our intention today would be to move 3097 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. We haven't adopted the dash fours yet.
We just, Mr. Chair, we just received the dash fours earlier today. And these folks will, we made some technical errors on the dash threes, and they will walk us through that, but they're here to speak to it in its current version.
Go for it.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. At the close of the last hearing, we expressed a desire to have additional testimony, and I'm assuming that that's probably not to the same folks who testified last time, but for the full committee. So to keep it brief, I'll just go through the changes in the amendments and then have other folks here available to add any perspectives. The dash fours really do
Excuse
four.
Me, you should, yes, huh? You did. Yeah, you did.
They have four pieces. I think from the perspective of our work group, they were all pretty small changes, but we want to make sure that you're well informed on them. The first were really just some changes in terminology. We didn't like the term pilot projects. We like the term demonstration projects because by and large, we're hoping that this doesn't pilot and go away, that this demonstrates value and that you want to keep it. The name of the funds, the fund where the monies will be allocated, was made consistent with the name of the grant, which is the primary care home collaborative fund. And there was a whereas where the word uninsured was used twice. Really small stuff. The second was we wanted to make sure that in the bill, the sections referred to under the waivers and the funding were consistent with our intent. The waivers would apply to the entire bill that was changed originally. It was just sections 1 through 5, and the funding would apply to sections 1 through 5. The third change was around nursing services. It specified that there will be a study on the impact of the cost of the Oregon Health Plan for including nursing services. It's actually representing the Oregon Nurses Association, an important part of this. We believe the study will demonstrate that it's cost-effective, in fact, probably smart to include nursing services because they end up providing health benefits that prevent people from getting ill. Go figure. So the changes in there are good. It also does enable the state to limit the pool of demonstration projects where nursing services are reimbursed so that we can assure the state that they can control the cost of that. It's not guaranteed to every grantee. It's upon a grantee's request and successful acceptance of that grant. So there will be some demonstrations with reimbursement for nursing services and others that won't have that, and that's fine. That helps us make this affordable to the Ways and Means folks. And fourth, we wanted to clarify in the section around limiting the length of grants and contracts to 10 pages and a standard of readability that we weren't talking about forms that were being filled out from the patients, the clients, but that these were the forms being filled out by the folks who were applying for the grant, i.e. the grantees. This is a section that, as we're demonstrating things, there's not really a review back to it, but I think the Representative Maurer's experience is not uncommon, that you do have a point of diminishing willingness to participate in some very well-intentioned state programs because the process of getting into the program and the contracts you have to sign is so cumbersome that the providers retreat from it. So I think we will demonstrate that it is possible in 10 pages of readable form to have a grant and contracting system that actually providers are willing to participate in. So those are the changes.
Any questions? Somebody else has anything
else? I might just drag these people up for no reason.
Mary, do you want to add anything?
Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Richardson, Co-Chair, Vice Chair Cannon. For the record, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Brennan. I'm with Pacific Source Health Plans. And I'm the Community Development and Policy Director there, as well as the Executive Director of their Charitable Foundation. I concur with everything that Martin just shared with you. It's basically just terminology changes, cleanup and clarity in the Dash 4s. I think it's a really exciting bill and an exciting opportunity for Oregon communities and in the Legislative Assembly, ultimately, to improve access to needed health care services while reorganizing the way to deliver those services and making sure they're effective, efficient, and sustainable. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Question?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Joel Young, and I'm with the Department of Human Services and was on the work group who put together the synthesis of these three bills. And I would, again, just reiterate what both of my colleagues have said about reaching general agreement on these additional changes, that they help provide some additional focus and clarification. They represent, I think, the sense and the spirit of the entire work group. And then overall, I think with these changes, if this bill were to pass, it provides DHS with the guidance it needs to achieve the purposes of the bill without being unduly restricted. So I think the art in something like this is for there to be enough clear direction so the department is not there's no ambiguity about what it is we're going to try to help communities achieve. And I think all of these changes have moved in the right direction to give us the tools to help communities really demonstrate what can be done in regard to medical homes, in regard to improving access, in regard to evolving delivery systems in the direction we'd all like to see them go. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I just want to put on the record today there was a demonstrance on the floor talked about how difficult your department was to deal with in terms of dealing with legislation. I just want to say I very much appreciate the positive activity that you've done. Although I assume you'll do what agencies I found do. They're always very nice, and then they put a $17 million fiscal on the bill, which is, I expect, what you're going to do to this one. But we'll fool you. We'll find the money for this.
Well, we will try to provide you a sound and credible fiscal, Chair Greenlee.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions?
I was going to ask you, Mr. Chair, if you'd entertain a motion.
I would entertain a motion. On the dash four amendments.
Right. I would move the dash four amendments to House Bill 3097.
There's a motion to move the dash four amendments. Any discussion of that motion? Is there any objection to that motion? The dash four amendments, I say, are not added. They are now 3097. And I would like a motion to move this to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3097 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion?
As amended.
Any discussion?
And one point in discussion, and that is, and perhaps it's something we'll hear just a little bit more about at the full committee, perhaps not, but that is the waiver request on MTALA. It gives me pause, at least. I mean, I think this is a pretty fundamental notion that we have in this country that someone upon, you know, showing up at the emergency room will receive care. And I understand we would only use this or only ask for this within very narrow circumstances of sort of immediately co-located care possibilities. But I guess I just perhaps would be interested in hearing just a little bit more about that and understanding those assurances.
That'd be very useful. Let's hear it before the full committee. But I would suggest that it may give pause to the proper authorities in Washington as well. It may not only be you.
Mr. Chair, I would echo what Representative Cannon just said, that the point is that it should take people aback that we're asking for DHS to pursue a waiver, because fundamentally, you know, providing services or healthcare services to people is not about anytime, anywhere, any place. It's about what is cost effective and what makes sense given the resource limitations that we have as a society, not just government, but as a society. And so we have to go back and relook at how we, from a position or a contextual framework, how we provide and what we provide and where we provide it. And so I really, frankly, do not expect that CMS is going to go roll over and say, hey, go ahead, because I think Congress would freak out. But the point is that this is an issue. If you've been in hospitals at all, and I've worked in various hospitals for a number of years, that this is an issue. And it's not about denying people that really need the care. It's about pointing them in the right direction and allowing those rules flexibility enough so that we have mechanisms, incentives to point them to where they need to be. But it's clearly not about denial of access.
And I assume that waiver is only within the context of these demonstrations. It's not a general
waiver. I would hope that is the intent. In fact,
that is the intent.
I mean, I'm tend to fall on the right side over here, and I see that the need for it, and I know that the other side is going to be just as cautious and more cautious about all of this. But, you know, everything has to be on the table.
And
everything.
It would be very interesting if we could find a way to do that where everybody gets the care they need, where it's not excluding care, but it turns out to be a more appropriate care. And that's what demonstration projects are for. Any other discussion? Would you please call the roll, Aaron?
Aye.
We'll come up.
Excuse. You can just note that.
Vice Chair.
Aye.
Vice Chair.
Aye. And Mr. Lamar, would you carry this to the committee, please?
Absolutely. Friday.
And it's scheduled for Friday.
Yes.
Okay. And it would be useful if the proponents are around to answer questions in a work session on Friday, if we have any. Representative Comp,
yes, sir.
Should we open up a work session on 3490.
Yes.
I understand we've made some headway on that, so I'm going to open a work session on 3490. Why don't you talk to us from your seat here?
Yes, thank you, Chair Greenlick. We met as we agreed to after we had the first public hearing on this and had a very productive one or two meetings, and we have reached agreement with the amendments as presented. I have to pull them out myself, but I think the proponents have told me everything is great.
We have.
And the insurers that we're working with them.
We have a dash one amendment, I think, is that right?
Yes. And also, Mr. Chair, you have a hand in gross bill, even though the amendment is pretty much a replacement of the bill,
yes.
The original bill.
And both, all parties are here if we have questions.
Could we ask Mr. Powell, is John here, are you prepared to talk about this from the insurer's side?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. We're in full support of the proposed language and appreciate the Ambulance Association cooperation and representing comp's encouragement.
Would you simply tell us what the amendments do?
Could I ask
I could.
Mr. Powell to
Powell,
do
ahead.
That
yeah.
much better than I could.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee,
two, right?
the thrust of the amendments are to simply say that as soon as an insurer has documentation that they can use to determine the coverage is due and payable, that they shall make that payment. And the original bill referred to one form, and that was problematic in that PIP coverage applies to people who are not named on the insurance policy. It could be a passenger, it could be a pedestrian in some cases. And so if we get this an ambulance bill for somebody that we have no record of, we have to have more information sometimes in order to pay that bill. So everybody worked together cordially and came up with this language that I think will help.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And maybe the ambulance group want to have any problem?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon State Ambulance Association, and with me is Sean Baird, who is the co-owner of Woodburn Ambulance and our legislative chair for the association. And we did meet, as Representative Comp explained, and we are happy with the amendment, and we very much appreciate the work of Representative Comp and of State Farm, Mr. Powell, and his colleagues. Thank you.
Chair Greenlick? The comment I would make is coming from although I represent Salem and Jervis and Woodburn, the reality is my heart's in small communities, and for small businesses to survive, they need to be paid like all of us, and I just hope this helps communities throughout Oregon.
Thank you. Well, would you like to propose a motion on the amendment?
I would be honored. Chair Greenlick, I move the dash one amendments into House Bill 3490.
Is there any discussion on those amendments? Is there any objection? Dash one amendments are now 3490.
Chair Greenlick, I move that House Bill 3490 as amended be referred to the full committee.
With a due-pass recommendation?
With a due-pass recommendation. Thank you.
We have a motion on the floor. Is there any discussion on that motion? Aaron, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. And Representative Comp, will you carry that to the committee?
Yes, sir. When will that be scheduled?
Oh, you're not on the committee.
No, I'm not.
Come before the committee.
You're doing it Friday?
I'm checking this
one. Monday?
Chair. It's on Monday.
Thank you.
It's on Monday. If you're here, we'll do it whenever you...
Thank you, Chair.
Whenever you're here. Close the work session on House Bill 3490. That's good work. I really appreciate that. I hope we will try and get some things settled.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee.
We have 3368 on the agenda. Let me open a work session on 3368. I would request that we have a motion on 3368 to move it to the full committee without recommendation. I don't expect to move it out of the full committee, but that seems like a good place for it at the moment, although conceivably we could move it to revenue. We can talk about that, but if I can get a motion to move that to the full committee, I'd appreciate that.
So, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3368 to the full committee without recommendation.
Is there any discussion on that motion? Will you please call the roll? We could wait for a second. One, two, three. Okay. Please call the roll.
Thank you. Aye.
Vice
Chair
Kennedy.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Richardson. Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3368 moves to the full committee without recommendation. That was the work session on 3368. Is it work here? Gels are here yet?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have two other bills. Is that all we have left?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
2918 and 3088.
Correct.
Why don't we stand at ease for a moment and see if we can find Representative Gelser? She said she thought she'd be here about 3:15. Oh, I'm sorry. We stand at ease. We have two different things we need to talk about today, and I think neither of them do we have the amendments we need. So we'll talk about them, and then we'll move them again without recommendation to the full committee. We have them scheduled on Monday and Friday, and see if we can figure out how to get the rest of the amendments we need. Representative Gelser, you want to talk to us about both of them, don't you? So.
I know I've been asked to come about 2918, and my office also received a call asking me to come about House Bill 3088.
All right.
So I am here at your
pleasure.
Why
don't we open 3088, a work session on 3088. And part of the question that I think you're here to talk about is the extent to which uninsured people are actually billed or attempted to be billed for full charges. Is that
is my understanding about why I'm here.
It would be really good to hear from you on this one.
All right.
You introduce yourself, please.
Yes, thank you.
We all know who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Representative Sarah Gelser, and I represent the part of Benton County that includes Corvallis and Philomath and two people who live in Linn County. I was asked to come and talk to you today a little bit about this question of whether or not individuals who are uninsured or do not have insurance at the time that they seek care end up paying more for their care than an insurance company would pay for that care if they were covered at that time. I believe that the reason that I was asked to come and talk about this is that ages ago, I can't believe that I have a child who is now 12, when I was pregnant with him, we moved from one insurance plan to another insurance plan, and due to a mathematical error on my part, and now I'm much better at math, this taught me, I went to the doctor for my first prenatal visit one day too early, and therefore my pregnancy was not covered for care. So as a result, my son was covered when he was born, which was very fortunate, but my pregnancy was not covered. And it was surprising to me because at that first appointment that
I had gone to. I'd gotten the estimated list of costs. I'd done my homework. We were very, you know, concerned about this. I was 20 years old, 21 the day after my son was born. And then the charges that we paid were much higher, I realized, than what the insurance company would have paid had they paid for what ended up being a cesarean section birth. At that time, I also had a very similar experience. Good Representative Richardson, in his newsletter the other week, recounted an experience that his daughter had. I had the same. I now read all of my medical statements line for line, and I do dispute and let my insurance company know when there are services charged for that haven't been provided. When I was asked this morning to come and testify on this, I telephoned my husband and asked him if by any chance he could put his fingers on our financial records or medical records from 1994, and if he could maybe get them to me in Salem by 3 o'clock this afternoon, at which point he laughed. he did, for comparison instead, send to me my insurance statements just for my just for the hospital portion of the costs for my second pregnancy that also ended up being a cesarean section birth. And the reason that this is relevant, what I want to share with you, is that when I went through this process with my son, we were billed an amount, and we were expected to pay that amount. We couldn't say, this is the disallowed amount, and we're not paying. We had to pay all of that. I understand that there has been testimony that uninsured people simply don't pay their bills. That was not our experience. Paying our bills is very important to us, and we were in debt for a while, but we were also very fortunate that we have ample financial resources, so it didn't mean that we were going without shelter or food, and we were very unusual, especially at the age of 21 and 22, that we were able to recoup that. But I added up all of these charges for a birth, and the total that was billed to the insurance company for my labor and delivery and newborn infant charges in March of 2001 was $28,963.84. The total amount that was paid, including what the insurance company paid and what I paid from my copay, deductible, etc., was $17,445.65, for a difference of $11,518.19. Or in other words, what was actually paid for my care was 40% less than what I would have paid out of pocket had I not been insured and been responsible for that cost myself. I understand that there is probably a difference between what is charged and what was charged to the insurance company or what was charged to me. That charge is the same, except for what is expected to be paid is very, very different. And I having this experience with my pregnancy 12 years ago, I look at the whole issue of cost shifting in healthcare in a very different way. We often talk about cost shifting to medical providers, cost shifting to hospitals for unpaid medical for uninsured individuals. However, for those uninsured individuals like me who I have the ability and the commitment to paying those bills, there is a significant cost shifting that is coming on to our shoulders as well. And that's also impacting those who choose not to participate in an insurance plan and are maybe looking for a health savings account or some other method of paying for their health care. They are paying more than other members of the community who have insurance, what is being paid on their behalf. And that has led me to a concern about the validity sometimes of the uncompensated costs that are reported, because an uncompensated cost for a hospital is calculated at that total amount of billed cost rather than that, which is higher for those uninsured than what an unpaid for an insurance would be.
You actually passed a bill that requires that to be by cost now, not by charges. And I hope that will settle that issue. But the issue you're raising is a very important one. Can I ask you a question? Was your copay based on the amount the insurance company paid or on the amount that was billed?
This was a couple of insurance companies ago. It was it was Regions HMO, and I'm looking here. I believe that we had a $15 copay for visits, and I think in hospitals I had a $50 per day.
It was the flat rate.
I don't think I was at an 80%. We'd been on other plans before where you paid 80% of the costs, and or you paid the
insured paid 20%, the insurance company paid 80% of the contracted charges, which is actually less than what the hospital bills.
Representative Maurer, do you have a question?
Well, it's more of a comment. You said you referenced HSAs, and HSAs, in order to have HSA, you have to have insurance, because that's kind of by definition. And so those insurance companies are contracted with the hospitals, so it would be their contract rate.
But the insurance is usually a catastrophic insurance over the top of an HSA.
No, it's only it's basically a $5,200 or whatever, $5,300 deductible for a family, and so they may have a max cap. But those caps are actually usually less.
I was thinking that you'd have to pay the $5,300, and if you had to pay the $5,300 at the full rates, I suppose it wouldn't matter if you got a $40,000 bill.
Right. I'm just, HSA is insurance, and it's what we're really talking about here are people that are truly uninsured.
Yes.
And have no negotiating power with these hospitals. And I'm very interested to see what hospitals are going to say about the outcome of this.
Well, we're going to hear in a minute, because we're not where we want to be on this. Is it safe to assume you have a little time to be with us?
I am yours until 4:30, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well then we'll get back on the other bill. Let's keep working this. Why don't you join us?
Okay. Thank you.
Quite welcome. To the committee, let me tell you where I've been working on this, and I've been taking some responsibility. 3088 has two pieces to it, and I need to get an amendment, which has not yet come, that will strip the second part out. It will delete, I think, Section 6, 7, and 8 of the original bill. And I've been working with the hospitals and with the proponents of the bill, SEIU, to try and come to some agreement on what the amount should be that should be paid in Section 2, 3, and 4 of the bill. My sense is up till now, the hospitals haven't gotten very close to where we're starting, and I'm not sure where that's going to go. Would somebody from the hospitals and somebody from SEIU like to come and chat with us on where we're getting with this? I do want an amendment that I think deletes.
The dash one deletes 6, 7, 8,
9, 10, 11, 12.
Dash
1.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have a dash 1. Is that all the dash 1 does? We have a Hannah Gross version here. Excuse us just a moment. Let's stand at ease for a second while we get the chair into the real world here.
That's what I hand in Gross. That should be
in Hannah Gross. Oh, it's in the existing bank?
Yeah.
Okay, we did get that.
Right, and I think that's really what you wanted it to do. But then, since the dash one, I got the threes. And
the dash one takes out two and deletes three and four.
Yeah, and the two looks nice.
Can I use Representative Menace's
pile? Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry. I could actually give you...
I'm sure she won't mind if you borrow it.
And I have a full packet over
here. That's great. It does do what I want. So the dash ones do the first thing I want to do. And before we're done, I'll ask for an amendment on dash ones. At the moment, the rest of the bill stands as it looks right now until we get an amendment that the parties agree to that changes the current proposal. And I'm perfectly willing. Actually, what I'd like to do before we're done today, just for simple purposes, is to accept the dash ones and move the bill as it is without recommendation to the full committee.
Got it.
We'll see if we can get somewhere else between now and, I think this is Monday again, or is this Friday?
Mr. Chair, this is up for, I wrote it down. 3088 is Friday, the 27th.
Friday. Okay. Would you introduce yourself and Marie, and if you'd like to, anything you'd like to say? And the gnome of Beaverton here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Marie Kreider. I'm here representing SEIU. And the Dash 1 amendments, as we understand them, do take what I would call the insurance parity, uninsured parity piece of the bill and strip out everything else. And that is an amendment that my organization can be supportive of. We have, at your direction, Mr. Chair, had some discussion with the Hospital Association to see if we might reach something that we could both be supportive of. And we met, 10 days or so ago, and sort of laid out our thoughts about this issue of what was an appropriate charge to the uninsured and did not reach agreement. I then had some brief conversation yesterday conceptually and then walked in this morning and saw the Dash 3s. So if you like, I can comment on the Dash 3s. I haven't had a chance to consult in the same way. Okay.
So we'll see if we can come somewhere else. We can, but if not, we won't.
Mr. Chair, I'm here then to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Bishop, do you have any comments?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman of the Committee for the Record. I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We're here in support of the Dash 3 amendments. I'd be glad to explain to the committee why we think that that would be the appropriate response for the legislature to take in this area.
Please do.
Dash 3 amendments make several significant changes that we'd like to bring to your attention. First of all, the Dash 3 amendments would modify the definition in the bill of uninsured that starts on line 12, page 1 of the bill. The reason for that modification is, as currently drafted, the bill refers to public or private health benefit plan. And health benefit plan is a defined term in the law and in the bill. And there is not a public health benefit plan. The Dash 3 amendments would correct that to specify that uninsured means not receiving state medical assistance and not enrolled in Medicare or a private health benefit plan. So it clarifies that because definitionally there's a problem in the way the bill was drafted. Secondly, and more importantly, the Dash 3 amendments would replace Section 3 with language that would prohibit a hospital from charging an uninsured patient with household income of under $100,000, an amount in excess of 85% of the bill charge, or the average amount paid to the hospital for the service by its commercial insurers, and would require that the hospital pick one or the other of those methodologies. Hospitals obviously could give additional assistance, but would be required to give at least a reduction of those amounts. Let me explain why we chose those two approaches rather than the approaches that are in the printed bill. Two of the major hospital systems in Oregon have been the subject of lawsuits challenging their charges to the uninsured. Those lawsuits resulted in settlements. One of those settlements uses the 85% of bill's charge amount as the basis for that hospital system's reductions for the uninsured. The other hospital system uses the commercial insurer average payment rate. So what we have attempted to do here is to codify the two approaches that have been litigated where a complaint was filed and there has been a settlement that was approved by the court and that those two hospital systems are subject to. These are the approaches that they worked out in conjunction with the plaintiffs in the lawsuit and that they are subject to. Those two settlements did not occur at the same time. They don't have the same terms. but those hospital systems are subject to those settlements. And what we've tried to do is to codify them and to give hospitals the option to choose one or the other of those two approaches.
Mr. Bishop, what would the hospitals think of those things, whichever one turns out to be left?
Yeah, I'm sure you can't answer off the top of your head. That might be something you could both consider. I think the original bill has the rate to the largest of the insurers. This would have the average rate paid to commercial insurers. Why don't you both consider whether that's a possible place where you can come down together? And that certainly wouldn't violate the legal settlement, because you could certainly charge less than you'd be required to under the legal settlement. Well, I don't expect an answer from either of you.
Thank you.
But, yep.
Representative Gelzer.
Thank you for indulging the question for me, Mr.
You're
Chair.
A member of the committee.
I am, aren't I? Thank you.
Indeed.
The full committee.
And welcome to everyone in the subcommittee meeting.
I'm glad to be here. I'm wondering what the reasoning is behind making that limitation of the annual household income of less than $100,000, and by what methodology you would determine that, and what that might mean for people that face a sudden, unexpected chronic illness where they may have in the previous year had a household income in excess of $100,000, but by virtue of their illness, lose their job, lose their insurance, and become uninsured with very, very high medical bills, since that is the most common reason people go into bankruptcy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelzer, the reason $100,000 was picked, and it varies obviously depending on family size if you're trying to relate it to a percentage of federal poverty, is that that's a substantial amount of income for a family. And if an individual who is uninsured has income more than that, it seems like they, by and large, with clearly exceptions such as you identified, public policy should be encouraging that person to get insurance and not to be uninsured. And if we have a policy that basically allows people the benefits of commercial discounts without the responsibility for paying insurance, and the family has or the individual has the income, seems like we're subsidizing, putting the subsidies inappropriately in a place where we can use the resources more effectively, for example, to subsidize other lower income individuals.
Can I follow up, please?
Sure.
So for a family that might have multiple children and one of those children has complex medical needs, complex disabilities, and that child has maxed out on their lifetime maximum of their insurance, that family may still struggle, even though that sounds like a lot of money when you're supporting three children, one of whom you might be paying thousands of dollars out of pocket to meet their needs every month. I'm just wondering what flexibility there is in here to recognize those unique family needs, especially given that uninsurance and medical costs are part of what really could contribute to that issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelzer, I think in the event that you, in the situation you proposed, where an individual has exceeded their policy limits, they would no longer be insured.
Yeah, they might be over $100,000.
Right, but they might be if they've got a child, if they've got a family member that they're supporting, the family income may be over $100,000. Their out of pocket cost to care for those children, and I know this, these are the families that I advocate for and serve, have thousands of dollars of out of pocket costs that they are paying, and they are working very hard. They might have an income that maybe seem high to any of us, but they are still struggling to meet basic needs because of those out-of-pocket costs. And I'm concerned that $100,000 with no reference to the number of children in a family, the needs of the people in the family, it's a very artificial limit, and it doesn't make sense to me why these people should be subsidizing the insurance industry or the state for its inadequate reimbursement on charges. It seems unfair to push it off on these people because of a arbitrary dollar amount that doesn't take anything else into consideration.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
If I may, this is tangential to the bill, but directly to your question, wouldn't that individual then become eligible for OMIT?
No, they would not, because if they have a child with a disability, they're judged on their parents' income, and currently in the state of Oregon, we provide absolutely no assistance for those children by virtue of their family income. They do not have access to care or coverage.
Thanks.
Okay. We're going to put the Dash 1 amendments in. We've got it on Friday. Let's.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we may talk again on Friday. We may need to move it to Monday. If you all can have some conversations and see where you can get somewhere you can get agreed to, I'd be happy to facilitate those conversations any way I can. And we can see where we're going on Friday.
Chair Greenlich, we would certainly be glad to have those discussions. I would say that I think the premise of the bill, and I think it's a good premise, is that we should be in this context dealing what is a basic fair price. We should not be trying to create a whole regime of charity care or financial assistance, and that is why we have proposed an approach that does not have a means test, would not involve application forms and proof of eligibility and all of that kind of thing. And so I would just share with you that I would take that philosophy into the discussion.
Please.
Mr. Chair, if I may also add that we understand that, but in the way this is designed, it is also giving a substantial benefit to people with substantial resources who could pay their bills. So there are situations at the extremes, obviously, both in terms of income and bills, but the policy needs to be carefully crafted. We're using a pretty broad brush here that is going to have to cover a number of situations because of the policy.
Yeah, I think the issue is if people choose not to have insurance because they're so wealthy they don't need insurance, they're probably wealthy enough that they can be charged what they're charged. But the fair price concept is something you ought to be thinking seriously about as well. So, if
Chair, may I add one final
please.
Comment or question? In all of the amendments, I believe Section 5 is left in the bill. That was not our intent with regard to that. Three amendments, we believe that the enforcement provision of treble damages is excessive. And if we were to advance our amendments by themselves, we would not include Section 5 in the bill. And I apologize for not mentioning that issue specifically.
Okay. Yeah, let's us at least have before us next time if we can a separate amendment that at least that's the five section, and we'll consider it at that time. Thank you. Can I have a motion on the Dash 1 amendments, please?
Mr. Chair, if the Dash 1 amendments sounds about 38.
Is there any discussion on that? Is there any objection? Dash 1s are part of House Bill 3088. Can I have a motion to move House Bill 308 as amended without recommendation to the full committee?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3088 as amended without recommendation to the full committee.
Is there any discussion? We'll revisit it on Friday. Would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. HB 3088 is moved to the full committee. I'll carry it. And the work and I close the work session on HB 3088. Dr. Goldberg is here, huh? Okay, let's open a work session on House Bill 2918. And I know that's what we held her over for. Representative Gelser has an amendment. Right. Dr. Goldberg, would you come and... Oh, sure they can. Or she can sit here. She doesn't even need to go up there.
You can be the director.
Well, congratulations, both of you.
We want to do three things with relation to House Bill 2918. I really appreciate it. I need to tell Representative Buckley and Representative Gelzer and others who've brought this question to our attention. There is no question but that we are faced with a terrible epidemic, a growing epidemic of autism, and one we're clearly not prepared to deal with. So I hope three things are going to come out of this, and I hope Dr. Goldberg will talk about two of them, and the third thing will be Representative Gelser's amendment, which we can have a chance to talk about and discuss as we go now. You're in a hurry?
I have another meeting I need to be at 4:30.
Okay, why don't we talk then about, is that the dash, what number are they?
Three.
Dash three amendments to House Bill 2918. Will you talk us through the dash three amendments?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Representative Sarah Gelser from House District 16, and I'm here to talk to you about the dash three amendment to House Bill 2918. This would stand independently. If you adopted this, you would not want to adopt the dash two. They do a similar thing. As we move,
we want some dash fours, I think.
Yes, I understand that. As we had conversations about this, there were many questions about the difficulties of the many questions that continue to swirl around treatment for autism specifically, and whether or not there should be additional mandates added to insurance to cover some of these treatments and procedures, and I hope that that's a question that we can continue to discuss. However, one of the other things that came up in the meeting is that even beyond those treatments that are specific for autism, children with autism or pervasive developmental delay, learning disabilities, developmental disabilities, mental retardation are routinely denied services that are available to other members of their family under the same health insurance plan because they are people with learning disabilities, and developmental delays. We did have some testimony at the public hearing that we had on 2918, the first public hearing, from the insurance industry that said that this was not true. However, I immediately received an email from someone that was listening on the Internet, and she emailed me a page from her Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance coverage booklet that listed as a specific inclusion, services are not covered for your covered child who it has a learning disability, a developmental delay, a developmental disability, Asperger's, or autism. And so what this amendment does basically is it just creates some equity within an insurance plan that says if speech therapy is covered for Betty in a family, it should also be covered for Ben, even if he has autism, at the same level of coverage that it's offered to Betty. So if Betty under the terms of that policy is eligible for 10 speech therapy visits in a year, then so is Ben eligible for 10 speech therapy visits in a year if that is medically necessary. And so what this does, it gives a very broad definition to pervasive developmental disorder as for the purposes of this preventing exclusions to include Asperger's syndrome, autism, developmental delay, developmental disability, or mental retardation. This amendment would not require any additional services or treatments to be offered through insurance companies than what are currently offered. It just means that every member of a family will be treated exactly the same as the other members of the family with the same limitations, but they cannot be excluded just because they're a person with a disability.
You've just said it as clearly as can be said, but I want to ask it again. The intention isn't to create new benefits for these kids or for adults in some cases. The intention is to simply make sure if there's a benefit that's available to somebody in that family or under that plan, then it's available, then it can't be denied simply because they're identified as one of these conditions. I'm not sure the wording exactly does that. And I think be very useful if we checked it. I mean, it says may not deny benefits to an individual who is covered under the plan because that individual has a pervasive development disorder. It sounds like it might make more benefit. I mean, you can't deny any benefits to that person.
Mr. Chair, I would point you to Section 2. Mm-hmm. The coverage for treatment of a pervasive developmental disorder may be subject to the same requirements in the plan that apply to physical illness generally, including copayments, coinsurance, or deductibles. So it puts it into that same plan.
Okay. Maybe we'll have a chance to check this with LC between now and Friday, but I think we'll adopt this today. Friday? Is this when we see this? We will. Put this to the committee, at least.
Monday.
Monday, great. This is a little more time.
Mr. Chair, if you did, I would be grateful, and I know that there are many families who would be grateful. While I know that it is not everything that some of the families that are raising children with autism and PDD are hoping for, it is something more than they're able to get, and this will reach out beyond that autism community to all children with disabilities to get them the very critical medical services that they need to be as healthy and independent as possible as they grow.
Good. Bruce, you want to talk about what else we're going to try and do?
Yes, for the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services. Chair Greenlick, you had indicated two things. I just want to be certain I speak about I know of one.
Why don't you talk about the one you know of, and I'll see if I can remind you in a second.
Okay. Very good.
After I find out which one you don't remember.
Okay. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm here to talk about putting together a working group to take on state-level leadership and collaborative planning to address what I think are the challenges that face all of us around children with autism spectrum disorders as well as their families. As Chair Greenlick indicated, this is a growing problem. And services are fragmented. They affect many families. They affect many places within the state. We struggle within our agency to create a coordinated approach in our programs, whether that be in our Medicaid program, in our programs for seniors and people with disabilities throughout the agency. Schools are also facing some of the same issues. There was a report. Actually, there have been two reports done in this state, one in 1995 and a second in 1999, that made a number of recommendations around improving services to these children and their families, but we have not updated those. It's now almost 10 years since the last one. There have been changes in the way we approach these illnesses, and it's really I think time to get together a broad group and begin to in essence revisit that 1999 plan, update it, and begin to make some recommendations for how we can deal with this as a state. I have to at this point just mention that My thinking through this was really helped by Catherine White, who's been very much involved in this and has helped me think through some of this and create some recommendations. And what I've spoken with Chair Greenlick about is that as an agency, we would be very happy to bring together a working group over the next year to begin to put together update the 99 plan, begin to create some recommendations, have this be broad-based. I've already taken the liberty of discussing this with Superintendent Castillo, and she's agreed that to have someone on her staff participate in this as well. And I think that we can really take a broad and good look at this and come up with some recommendations for the state and how to approach this problem.
Well, that's very great. And it might be nice if you include a legislator or two on it to help.
We'd be happy
to. Well, I was thinking to make sure you have some receptors at this end with things that obviously are going to take some action in the next legislature.
I can think of some that might be interested. Well,
nothing. I'm just thinking that there's more than one of us that are interested in this topic.
Well, nothing. As my grandmother used to say, we should all have such problems. It's much better to have a choice of many who are interested than to feel like we're twisting the arms of those who aren't. So I think we'll be able to accommodate.
Don't
interest.
Get too many. You get too many legislators, you have nothing but problems.
Yeah.
you have the resources to carry this out. This isn't requiring extra resources.
Chair Greenlick, we believe this is part of the charge we have as part of our agency and part of our responsibilities, and we can do this.
And I misspoke about the other. I forgot you're also not director in the Office of Health Planning and Research. So I'll talk to somebody else about the third item.
Okay, very good. That's what I thought.
You remind me. It's hard to remember what job you have. Yeah.
Okay.
I see the director here, though. We can talk about that as well.
Great.
Bruce, thank you very much for... the third thing that we have some agreement on, which I want to have an amendment to put in the bill, is that the Office of Health Policy and Research will work with us and commit the Health Resources Commission to a study on the state of the art in behavioral and medical treatment for autism, which I think might be very helpful to feed some of this. Janine, Dr. Smith, would you join us? That amendment is not here.
Mr. Chair, would you accept my apologies and excuse me? Thank you.
Excuse for house business.
Myself as well.
You're excused as well. Thank you very much for the work you've done. Let's beat up on Dr. Smith.
Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Janine Smith, the administrator these days. It's for the Office of Health Policy and Research. And I also sit on the PEB board, and we recently had a PEB discussion about coverage for this disorder, and we wrestled quite extensively about not really understanding what the evidence is or isn't around this, and I think it's really timely, and I've spoken with Gene Thorne and the other members of the PEB board, and they're very interested in being aware and participating as best they can as well in this, because it would really help inform them to make decisions for the state employees. And I think what we were proposing in the amendment is just to direct the Health Resources Commission, as they have done medical technology assessments and pharmaceutical drug reviews, to review the literature of both medical and behavioral health in collaboration probably with the Health Services Commission, which has a behavioral health subcommittee that some of those members would probably also be interested in this, and then closely with DHS and the Department of Education, so we can get a real broad-based review perspective of what the literature says.
You helped my staff get. I think we're trying. We're in process.
I worked with Tom yesterday, and I gave him some words to suggest.
Great, Dr. Smith. Thank you very much. Are there any questions, Dr. Smith? Okay. Thank you very much. Can I have a motion to adopt the -3s, the 2918?
Mr. Chair, I move the -3 amendments to House Bill 2918.
Is there any discussion on those amendments?
Mr. Chair, I would only ask my colleagues maybe down at that end of the dais whether, to their reading, this would be added to that list of mandates that we impose on insurance companies. You know, I don't know if it's 24 or 32, but I've seen the number. Is this going to be one more or not? Because in the presentation we got about the -3 amendments, it actually sounds like it's not a mandate. It's not adding additional requirements for coverage. It's merely requiring equality among coverage. So,
and I would ask if the insurance folks have a chance to think this over. They haven't had this amendment, and this is Monday, right? If they have a chance to comment to us on Monday how they feel about it, would that work?
You can get LC.
Yeah, well, Representative Maurer.
May I comment to Representative Cannon's question?
Absolutely.
Thank you. In fact, that's why I went over and talked to Representative Richardson, and basically the question was, well, how do you argue the logic of Representative Gelser? Because, I mean, when you look at this on the face, this falls into the category of, you know, another mandate. But the way the language is reworded here, or the way I read it, or the intent of how I read it, I'm not a lawyer, maybe Representative Richardson could correct me, but, I mean, this is about fairness in a policy, and if now we're parsing words of what is and isn't a mandate, I don't think this rises to the level of a mandate.
If it really says what we want it to say, I will check that again with LC. Yeah, if it says if you're covered, then everybody ought to get that coverage and not be excluded because they have some condition.
We will cover hair implants unless you're bald.
Well, I understand the logic of
that. That one makes sense to me. All right, and we will ask for comments on Monday and see what folks think about it. Is there any objection to adding dash threes to the 2918? Then dash threes are added. I'll ask again for a motion to move 2918 as amended to the full committee without recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2918 as amended to the full committee without recommendation.
And is there any discussion of that? Erin, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2918, as amended with the dash threes, is moved to the full committee, and we'll ask Representative Gelser to carry it to the full committee, and we should have at least dash fours and maybe some other dashes by Monday, and we'll get them to you as soon as we can.
Humanly possible.
And unless there's something else to be brought before the committee, I think we've completed the agenda. Amazingly, 30 minutes early. Maybe with this precision, we won't have to have pajamas on Monday. We'll see.
We'll be taking a couple of those off, so there'll be some tweakage on that agenda.
Yeah, there are several things that we probably won't hear, or at least we won't spend much time on that agenda. Okay. And we are adjourned.